Welcome to Great Australian Lives.
For Tobin Brothers Funerals,
celebrating lives. Here's your host, Laura Turner.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight first began his career as a paramedic in 1986, and in that 35 years has performed clinical, operational and leadership roles and has played a pivotal role in reshaping the way our modern ambulance services operate. He's the recipient of an Ambulance Service Medal for his contribution to the development of ambulance services at a state and national level, and has been awarded for his significant contributions to improving cardiovascular health and resuscitation practice and outcomes. Changes which have no doubt saved many, many lives. He's now the CEO of Ambulance Victoria, steering the organisation through one of the most remarkable periods in its history. It is my pleasure to welcome Tony Walker, ASM, to Great Australian Lives. How are you, Tony?
I'm good, thank you, Laura. Very well, thanks.
What a mouthful. You have achieved so much.
It's been an interesting career, I've got to say. It's you don't start out looking for these accolades and doing the things you do, but they've sort of crept up over the years as I've been involved in various different things. So it's really nice to have them, but it's they often just reflect the activity and the things that I get a lot of pleasure out of as well.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it's an honour to every Victorian listening to have someone so well experienced and celebrated at the helm of Ambulance Victoria, which is, I can't and obviously state enough how important it is right now. Has there ever been a more challenging time to be a paramedic than right now?
No, I don't think there has been a more challenging time, Laura. I think it's probably the toughest time that certainly in my 35 years, I've never seen it like this. And, you know, at the front line particularly, I mean, everyone's busy across the organisation, but at the front line, our paramedics and first responders, it's a really tough gig at the moment. And you know, after 2 years of pretty full-on work on the back of the bushfires, it just hasn't stopped. So, no, they're pretty weary, I've got to say.
And I've always said, and I don't want to sound like I'm blowing your trumpet, but I don't have more respect for anyone than a paramedic. You guys just do the most incredible work in some of the most trying conditions. And at the moment, that COVID outbreak is just, I can't imagine how stressful it must be going to work every day, as you always do, risking your own lives. But this really is, you know, right in the face of risking your own health every day, isn't it, for your staff?
Absolutely, it is, Laura. I think if you think about it, you know, most of us are being asked to stay at home and to not put ourselves at risk. They go out every day. They leave their families. They are putting on hot, uncomfortable personal protective equipment and are essentially exposing themselves to patients that are infected. And we know that particularly at the moment. And then have those same worries of their own health, making sure that they don't take it home to their families. And then they've got all the same issues that we're all facing around, you know, homeschooling with kids. Some of their partners may have lost their jobs. The other added pressures, and then on top of that, going out there into this difficult environment. So no, it is really tough at the moment for them, and I think it's a real credit to them. They keep coming back every day because it's what they signed up for. It's their passion. It's the thing they do that they know makes a difference every day.
Tony, recently in the news, we heard that you know, paramedics may not have been being updated when they arrive at a scene that it is a COVID patient. Has that been rectified?
Yeah, Laura. We found early on that, and it's interesting during a pandemic, the things that you can do that sometimes technologically people tell you can't be done. I'm sure, I mean, we're often talking on video conference and things at the moment in those sort of ways. But no, we've been able to work with the Department of Health to actually connect up the information they have to our dispatch system. So paramedics that go out to cases now where there's a known COVID positive patient at an address, we'll have that information before they get there, which is great. It's just one more thing. I mean, they're prepared for every patient, assuming that they'll be infected. It's just the nature of the work. But to have that added security to know that, well, actually just be a little bit more cautious when I go here is really good, both from the mental health point of view and just on their preparedness as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Also recently we learnt that it was your second busiest day on record, second to that freak thunderstorm asthma event a couple of years ago. The overload on the system must just be enormous, and COVID patients are the ones who are creating that high level.
Yeah, that's right, Laura. I think if you look right now, our health system has probably never been under as much pressure. In fact, it's never been under as much pressure as it's on at the moment. And so what we're seeing is increasing numbers of cases in the community. It's driven by lots of different things. It's driven primarily, as you said, by increasing numbers of COVID cases. But we've also been increasingly busy just over the year on the back of the last year's lockdown, where we saw people who may not have been able to see their GPs, not through any fault of their own, they just were, you know, not able to get out. Their GPs may not have been able to see them because of their restrictions. And so we saw a lot of sicker people at the beginning of the year, and that's continued through. And then you overlay on top of that now the Delta variant and sicker people in the community. Yes, we've had, over the last few weeks, five of the busiest days in our history, and only a second to thunderstorm asthma. And it's forced us now to make a number of changes to essentially change the way we deliver ambulance services. And we'll be like that for the coming months, where we now have different people working with us as co-responders to increase the number of ambulances we have out there, changing the way we take calls when people dial 000. So we're in for a very, very busy few months ahead. But I'm an optimist, Laura, and I think, you know, we will come out the other side of it. And, you know, but it's going to be very busy over the coming months. And not just for our paramedics, but the whole system is under that inordinate pressure.
Yeah, and as you say, we will come out the other side. We have some extraordinary people working in our health services, in our ambulances, in our hospitals. But as you just mentioned, we're going to have people like the Defence Force driving ambulances. And when people call 000, there'll be another number to call, won't there, for a lesser emergency type situation. Correct me if I'm wrong. That's really historically changing things, especially having ADF personnel driving the ambulances. I mean, we've never seen this before.
No, we haven't. And what we've done is we're trying to encourage people to not call an ambulance if it's not an emergency. Now, that's hard, because I know emergency means lots of different things to lots of different people. And if they're in stress and concerned, you know, the phone's there to pick up, and I understand that. But we're highlighting to people there are other services they can go to, like their GP, like Nurse On Call, where they can ring Nurse On Call to get its expert advice 24 hours a day. And then basically by doing that, that takes a bit of pressure off the system. At the same time, we're increasing the number of crews. And you're right, we've never seen Defence Force personnel. We've got 200 student paramedics, 30 university students out working with us at the moment. We've got highly trained first aiders from St John and SES volunteers. And really it's about saying paramedics are still delivering care, but it's about how do we take two paramedics off a vehicle and to convert that to two vehicles, so we've got more resources out there.
Where do you get the extra ambulances from? That was my...
Yeah, so we've been planning for this last year or so. So we've kept back a lot of fleet that were due to be replaced, so we've increased that. We partnered with the private providers of non-emergency transport to access some of their fleet. So we've got about 200 additional ambulances in reserve that we can access if we need to over the coming months. So it's been a lot of work to prepare for it, but we've never seen the triggers up until probably this last week that have said, actually, now we need to activate it. So it's you plan for these things, but the day comes when you go, actually, now it's time to turn them on.
Can the ADF guys, I know St John probably can, but can the ADF guys, the SES people, drive an ambulance like you guys can? Because I've sat in the back for work jobs and personally, and you guys, I've never seen anything like it. It's extraordinary. It's amazing. I mean, you always feel safe. Can these guys get a special training? I mean, I know they drive army vehicles and that, but can they drive like you can up the tram lines?
It's an interesting question. So we've got a first responder program that's operating in country Victoria for decades. And so we train up local first responders to work with paramedics in small rural towns. So we've taken that program and applied it now to the ADF and to St John and to others. So part of that is a familiarisation with driving, but they won't be doing licensed sirens driving. So, and we'll try and send these crews to the less sick patients so our two paramedic crews can go to the sicker ones. So they'll be able to give a comfortable ride, But no, they won't be getting the opportunity of doing the lights and sirens down down Bourke Street, as much as I'm sure they would love to. It's an experience, as you know.
What happens if a patient's condition deteriorates to the point where we do need lights and sirens? I mean, they can't sit in the back. They can't swap roles.
They'll simply just still drive carefully to hospital. So yeah. We will have other crews and other resources that we can respond to them if they need it. So, you know, particularly in Melbourne, there are other resources around that can come to them. But if that was those circumstances occurred, it would still be a very careful drive, because the last thing you want to do is create a situation where the adrenaline actually makes the incident worse than it potentially is at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of PPE, I mean, I know it's been an issue in the beginning of COVID. We sort of were running low on PPE. It must add another layer of complexity, being fully suited up in all that PPE you need just in case the patient has COVID. I mean, you'd be ripping through it.
Here we are. We are. Every patient, in fact, you know, you could walk in and out of an emergency department and potentially change it two or three times on one case. So we're going through a lot of it. Supply is not an issue. I think early on, like the rest of the world, it was sort of no one was sort of prepared for this. But we never actually had any challenges getting PPE last year. Although, you know, we were some days it was getting lower than we'd like it, but we always had it available. But it's certainly no issues for supply now. And it is hard. It's you're putting on a really hot mask. You're putting on a gown over the top of your uniform. You're wearing protective goggles, gloves, and as we come into summer particularly, you know, it's very hot. So I think that's one of the big things we're working on at the moment. How do we ensure we can keep our crews cool? Because, wearing this stuff, it can be stifling. And it obviously protects them. And, you know, we've had a small number of people that have been infected. At this stage, probably not at work, most likely outside of work. But it is a very difficult thing to do. They're used to it, but it's uncomfortable. It's the best way to describe it. It's uncomfortable and hot.
Yeah, and I can't imagine just having the rubbing sores on your nose and your ears and all those things that, you know, you just have to just cope with on the job. It's hats off to you guys. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. For more information, tobinbrothers.com.au. Our guest tonight is Tony Walker, the CEO of Ambulance Victoria. And more with Tony in just a moment. Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight is Professor Tony Walker, ASM, registered paramedic and Chief Executive Officer of Ambulance Victoria, with more than 35 years' experience working in the ambulance sector. Now, Tony, before the break, we were talking about the hardships on paramedics, and I'm sure many of them don't want to hear that word. They're humble, they're hard workers, and they do the job because they love it. But getting around in all that PPE, as you say, can be stifling, especially in summer. But on top of that, we have seen campaigns to help bring down the violence some people can display towards ambulance officers, whether it be from stress or whether they're under the influence of illicit drugs or that sort of thing. Have we made progress on that front outside of COVID? Do you think we're doing better?
We're doing a lot more work to better identify people who may put paramedics at risk, and to both fight for the call and also at the call, I should say, and when paramedics are assessing them. But violence is still an issue out there. So occupational violence, I mean, I see every day an incident where a paramedic has been abused, assaulted, spat on. It is sadly still the environment that's out there. So while we're seeing, you know, a reduction in alcohol and drug issues, particularly during lockdown periods, we know that they become less of an issue for us because people aren't out in the streets celebrating and enjoying themselves maybe a bit too much sometimes. The issues of violence are still there, and it's a confronting issue that, you know, and for me as a CEO, as much as I invest into try and train up and do all the things we do, I can't make their workplace 100% safe, and it does distress me, I've got to say, to see and to hear these stories. And I've had paramedics whose careers have been ended because of occupational violence. It's horrendous. It's still out there, Laura. So, yeah, as much as we're doing on it, as much as the community campaigns are helping the conversation, it still occurs every day.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it makes me so angry to hear that and upset. But yeah, as you say, you can protect your guys, but you can't stop it happening unless people are listening. Has COVID heightened tensions towards paramedics in terms of like vaccine status? You know, because that can be a really controversial and touchy issue. And if someone's sick and then they say, well, I haven't had the vaccine, and has that created issues in the back of an ambulance?
Not that I'm aware of, Laura. I know sometimes, like, we ask patients to put masks on, for example, and there are some people that, will often be unhappy about that, and our crews work through those issues. I'm not aware of any specific issues around vaccine conversations. I mean, we're non-judgmental. I mean, obviously, we want to see every person vaccinated because we know it protects them and protects the people they love in their community. But we're not judgmental. I mean, you know, the nature of our job is that we see things and are exposed to things that, you know, are preventable every day. And while you may have a personal view about that, you know, you put on your game face and you deal with them as a person needs help at that time, albeit you know that potentially it could have been prevented through vaccination. But, you know, our job is just to provide the best care we can and to take that person's particular needs in at that time.
Yeah, and that you do. I've never met a judgmental paramedic, and I've come across many of them in my work and private life. In terms of mental health, you actually were a finalist in the Australian Mental Health Prize in 2019, recognised for your work improving paramedic mental health. There is no time like the present in terms of paramedic mental health, I could imagine, except I guess after big incidents like Black Saturday and all of those. But this is a long, draining, changing situation with COVID. How hard is it for you to safeguard the mental health of your workforce in such extraordinary circumstances, given how hard they're working? There's not a lot of downtime at the moment, is there?
No, and that's a really good point you've raised, because downtime, spending time with your mates, debriefing cases, the camaraderie, they're protective factors. They actually protect the mental health and wellbeing of our paramedics and first responders. And so not being able to do that as easily during the pandemic has actually impacted on their mental health and contributed to making it worse because of the other environmental things they're dealing with. We've done a lot of work over the last 5 or 6 years to try and make mental health a much more destigmatised routine conversation in our workplace. And we moved from sort of having the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff approach, where, you know, we treated people who were really having significant mental health issues, which we still do, to early intervention. And I've got to say that's been a godsend for us now, because we've got psychologists, chaplains, peer support staff and others, and an environment where people are more prepared to talk about their mental health and to recognise in themselves when they might be struggling and to get that help. And to their credit, I should say, we've seen a 25% increase in our staff accessing our psychologists over the last 18 months or so. Their families as well, so their families are using our psychology services, because, as you can imagine, as a paramedic, it may not be the case or the job you're going to that's the problem, it's the challenge. It's the fact that you've got significant issues with your teenage children who can't get to school, and you bring that into the workplace because you can't leave it behind. So our mental health services support both their family and work-based issues, because we know those two things are interlinked. So our staff are using those services. But there's no question in my mind at all that their mental health has been impacted on by the pandemic, and there will be a significant recovery period. And I expect, Laura, we'll have some paramedics at the end of the pandemic who will go, I probably don't think this is my job anymore. I think it's probably time to do something else, which would be sad, and we hope we can keep them. But, you know, I think a lot of people are hanging in there because of the sense of obligation to their community. And I think once we get back into whatever our new normal is, I think both paramedics and other health professionals, and probably lots of people in the community, will give some consideration, what am I going to do next? Because maybe I don't want to do this anymore, and which is a shame. But we acknowledge that this impact could be long-lasting.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that will go across all industries. It's been a real changing turning point for a lot of people, personally and professionally. I certainly can agree with that. Just on that, professionalism and occupation, how did a young Tony Walker end up as in the ambulance, in this industry? Where, you know, when you're a young boy with your socks pulled up and maybe your footy shorts on, Did you envisage you'd be in the back of an ambulance one day?
No, I didn't, Laura. My mum's a nurse, or was a nurse, and so I think I've probably been exposed to, like many who take health professions, to her experiences, and I'm sure that was a heavy influence. I initially worked as an operating theatre technician after I left high school, and so I was, you know, helping set up anaesthetists with the anaesthetics and setting up operating theatres. So you got a sort of exposure to the health system pretty bluntly, we were saying, that sort of role. But I decided, well, actually, I'm not sure this is going to be my career forever and what's next. I thought about nursing and did sort of dip my toe in the water thinking about that for a bit. But it was interesting. Working in the operating theatres on a night shift a few times, you'd have really sick patients being brought in by the mobile intensive care ambulance directly into the theatre. And so you got chatting to the paramedics on that, and all of a sudden I'm thinking, well, that looks like an interesting job. I mean, it's a, you know, you're making a difference. I could see what they were doing to make a difference to people's lives, and that got me interested in saying, I think this would be a good career path to follow. Took a few years to get in, like it often does with any career, because they're demanding. Lots of people want to do it, but eventually got in the mid-80s and have loved it ever since. It's sort of scary to think it's been 35 years, but no, it was. I think I always was going to take a caring profession, but didn't sort of grow up thinking this was the one I wanted.
Yeah, well, and one of the first or one of the early jobs you did was the Wall Street Murders. I know that. That must have been. And for those listening who don't remember that, that's when two young police officers were gunned down. That must have been just horrific for a young paramedic like you and one of the first people on scene.
Yeah, it was, well, you know, it's still just as vivid in my head today as it was all those years ago. To attend a case like that and the emotion at the time, I probably, you know, you get into the, you're trained up well, and so you do the things you're trained to do. It's interesting reflecting afterwards. It's probably had more of an impact on me as I got older, you know, because but it's because the anniversary's come up, you know, the 30th anniversary was a couple of years ago, and to meet up with families and others. But no, there were four of us who attended that day. Three of us are still in the ambulance service, and there's no doubt the case, the emotion of it. And the senseless loss of life, and you know, particularly when I think nowadays of the fact that they were my age back then. They were young men who had their whole lives ahead of them that were cut short. And they're jobs that never leave you. I often describe it's a collage that sits in your head, and I think every paramedic's the same. There are cases you attend that will stay with you for the rest of your life, and you just learn to live with them and sit with them comfortably. And there are cases you drive past places where you know you've attended things. It's constantly there, and that comes down to, as you described before, how we manage our mental health and make sure we're, keeping ourselves in top mental health condition to make sure those things don't get out, because they are below the surface, and other things can come into our lives that let them out and can have some profound impacts on people. I've been fairly fortunate. Throughout my career, I see a psychologist regularly to help me be successful in my role. But I've never been in a situation where I've not been able to deal with the circumstances in front of me. I've got many of my colleagues who have been profoundly impacted on, who have either not in the job or who are still struggling to this day with I suppose the demons of a career. Maybe those that didn't have these services that we can get now. So many older paramedics retire with these things that follow them through into their retirement as well.
Yeah, I can well imagine. And Tony, I mean, even in my career, which is absolutely not a patch on what you guys do, but even as a news reporter, and my partner's a cameraman, and we just even driving through Melbourne, it's quite sad if you've got friends in the back seat and you'll be saying, oh no, I know where that is. That's where that multi-fatal was that day. And you just turn around the corner after that and you'll find the pub, or, you know, oh yeah, up in Horsham, yeah, that's where that truck rolled over, and you know, all that. But it's you do really have to look after your mental health, don't you? Because it gives you tunnel vision of the world.
It's very true.
Yeah.
It's very true. I think this whole issue about mental health, I think, you know, it is about recognising and often seeing yourself when things aren't going well, so that you can put in interventions to deal with it, because, you know, it's, as I mentioned earlier, you know, things can go along nicely, but things change in our life, and the pandemic are doing that now, that all of a sudden, you know, the normal protective things aren't there.
This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. For more information, tobinbrothers.com.au. And we'll be back with Tony Walker of Ambulance Victoria in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Tonight, our guest is Tony Walker, the CEO of Ambulance Victoria and the recipient of an Ambulance Services Medal for his contribution to the development of ambulance services at a state and national level. We've been talking about such interesting stuff tonight, Tony. Your insight into, health incidents in Victoria, but even, you know, incidents we read about in the paper, crime scenes, as you mentioned before, the Wall Street murders. But with crime scenes, this is particularly interesting to me. As a paramedic, you're often one of the first people there on scene. How do you get around disturbing what could be, what often is, a crime scene?
It's a really good question, Laura. So our primary focus is always patient lives. So where someone is injured, then it becomes our paramount focus. So if that means the crime scene might be disrupted, we wouldn't do it deliberately, but our focus is on the individual. Clearly, in circumstances where our services aren't required, so someone may have died at a scene, then we are exceptionally careful, because at that time, you know, there is no life to be saved, sadly, but there is an opportunity for the perpetrator to be found through investigation. So we have undertaken training to help us be sensitive to crime scene issues and to avoid doing anything that might impact on that, but at the time of an incident, if someone's still alive, it's our primary focus, and the police absolutely recognise that. And we've never had any conflict in that space. It's very much a recognised role. It's just when we don't need to provide that care, yes, it's absolutely critical that we're not disrupting that scene.
Yeah, I can imagine. I was just going to ask whether there has been sort of, because there'd be a lot of respect between the different professions on scene, but whether there has been incidents where it's got to court and you've gone, oh, whoops, we know, smashed glass or, I don't know, whatever. But it sounds like you haven't.
It's a good question. It's a good question. I mean, in the sense, just to give you an example, I mean, you mentioned before the Wall Street shootings. And so for me, the next day, police did come and take my boots. To differentiate my footprints from others that might be at the scene. Yeah. So there was often those type of things where if we're there or we've left equipment, that they'll come and confirm those equipments are ours. Yeah. Certain drugs we've given, they'll confirm are those drugs you gave. Mm-hmm. That type of thing, just as part of the investigative process. Which we obviously completely support them with whatever they need for that.
Yeah, a lot of stuff behind the scenes that we as the public wouldn't be aware of. I want to talk to you too about your work with the Prostate Cancer Foundation. You're also the non-executive director of both the Prostate Cancer Foundation and the Emergency Services Foundation. First of all, do you have any time for anything else?
my wife would say absolutely not. I'm often challenged by taking on new things that interest me or that I think I can make a difference on. Particularly, I've got a 6-year-old daughter, so there is a sense of trying to balance those things. But there are things that myself, I had prostate cancer at 47. So for me, that was a good example of one that I'm passionate about. I do have to say no, and I'm getting better at it for some things that I'd love to do, but just don't have the time, particularly at the moment, for obvious reasons.
Yeah. What does your role with the Prostate Cancer Foundation involve? What do you do for them?
Well, I started off as an ambassador after I'd been diagnosed and treated for my prostate cancer. I just felt that I wanted to give something back. And so I spoke to a lot of men who were challenged by their prostate cancer experience. So started off as an ambassador talking to men about prostate cancer, and then got involved in their community outreach group to help give advice about how to engage the community and other men and their families. And then a few years back was invited onto the board. So I'm non-executive director on the board of the Prostate Cancer Foundation with some wonderful people who are basically ensuring that organisation can be doing the best it can be in both raising funds and delivering care to men and their families across Australia. And also chair their National Outreach Committee. So part of that is about, again, making sure the services we offer meet the needs of all men and their families, that we're not going in a particular direction that actually isn't hitting the mark. So it's been a great thing to be involved with, a wonderful organisation, and I see the outcomes from it. In fact, I spoke to a man who was, you know, just recently dying with prostate cancer, who a family member had put me onto and was able to talk to him through what his options were, and to give him some comfort, because, as you know, men, particularly of a certain age, don't like to talk about their health, and another man being able to chat to them about that, and particularly given how I've had that lived experience, can make a world of difference to them, because I can talk about things like continence and sexual dysfunction, a whole lot of stuff that you know, they're never going to talk to anyone else about. And because I've been through it, they're happy to chat about it with me.
So important. And just to add to all the things on the wall in your pool room, you've been awarded the National Heart Foundation's President Award and the Australian Resuscitation Council Medal for Award for contributions to improving cardiovascular health and resuscitation practice and outcomes. You, as I said before, are the busiest man in Australia. And you have said before, it takes a community to save a life, and we're only as good as the people there before us. In relation to a sudden cardiac arrest and the survival rates, There's pretty important information around that, isn't there, in terms of giving CPR before an ambulance arrives?
Absolutely, Laura. I think, you know, we've got, and I'm showing my bias here, one of the best, if not the best, ambulance service in the world. And in the care we provide, the clinical skills, the training. But it's what someone does in those first few minutes before we get there that makes such a difference. So when someone collapses, calling 000, starting those life-saving care, which is just simple compression on the chest now, it's much easier to do. Using a defibrillator, an automated defibrillator that can just advise a shock if one's needed, and you don't have to be trained up to use one of those either. We see the outcomes every day of people that are alive. In fact, you know, we've got some of the highest rates of survival in the world, second to Seattle. And you know, people are going home who are clinically dead because of this great system of care, underpinned 100% by what that person did in those first few minutes. And that's why we've been doing a lot of work over the last few years to simplify the messaging and to connect people up now through apps, our Good Sam app, where any member of the community can be connected and alerted if they're nearby someone in a cardiac arrest. So and to start that life-saving care. So it's been one of the most gratifying things in my whole career. I've seen the evolution of, you know, this is 50 years of our mobile intensive care ambulance this year, which started off in the early 70s, and now we're seeing today this whole system of care where the community and our paramedics work hand in glove to save lives, and it's making a difference. People are going home, living great lives. In fact, 75% of people who are in cardiac arrest go home to their families and back to work. So it's not a situation anymore where, you know, it's people are in nursing homes or anything. People are living quality lives for many, many years to come. It's wonderful.
Yeah, back at the desk. I was dead yesterday. Now here I am.
It's true. It's literally true. And people, in fact, now a lot of the work is about how we work in survivorship. A lot of our team, Professor Karen Smith and our team and her colleagues, doing a power of work in how do you support people with survivorship, because now they're living with the mental health and other issues that come from having suffered a cardiac arrest and the thoughts of that, and how do you protect and support that part of their lives now, which is, to be honest, a great place to be, where you're focusing on their well-being in a circumstance where many years ago we were focused on the fact whether they're going to live or die. So we've come a long way. It's got to say, a long way in the last few decades.
Now, Tony Walker, we're a competitive bunch in Australia. You mentioned we're second only to Seattle. How do we beat them? How do we get ahead?
Well, it's a really interesting one. So we're constantly, and we're constantly looking at this mantra of measure and improve. And we're actually working closely with places like Seattle and other groups of the Global Resuscitation Alliance to go, what are you doing differently? And that's where Good Sam came from. We looked at some of the services and go, well, actually, that's a good idea. We can put that in here. So we're doing a lot of work in benchmarking, getting under the hood of those services and sharing ideas. And I keep saying Seattle, if you look at Seattle in its true size, it's about the size of Melbourne. And actually, we're not that far off. I think they're about 56% survival in the same equivalent to Melbourne. We're about 55%. So we're getting close. But of course, you know, as a statewide service, I have to talk about the whole state. And so, you know, it's often about how you measure apples and apples and those type of things. So we're not far off Seattle, but it is our goal. I've been, you know, we're aiming to improve cardiac arrest survival every year and to keep challenging ourselves, not only the people who survive, but ask ourselves the question, why didn't that person survive and what could we do differently next time?
When we beat Seattle, when we inch ahead, I want to hear about it. There's got to be at least a tweet. There's got to be a media release, something, Tony Walker. I want to know. It's in my nature. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And in these challenging times, Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. For more information, tobinbrothers.com.au. Our guest tonight is Tony Walker from Ambulance Victoria. He is the CEO there, among many, many other things, and we'll wrap things up with him in just a moment. Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Our guest tonight is Tony Walker, ASM, registered paramedic and chief executive officer of Ambulance Victoria, with more than 35 years' experience working in a range of senior clinical, operational and leadership roles within the ambulance sector. He's a very busy man, but he has time for us tonight. And I want to know, among all of these things we have celebrated, Tony Walker, what else do you do with your time? What are you fitting in? How do you enjoy yourself?
I like sleep. So sleep's very good. I find it very regenerative. So that's a big one if I can get it. So that's a good one. I like reading. So reading is something I get a lot of pleasure out of. Television. So, you know, binging. I've only just recently discovered Ted Lasso. I can't believe I must be the last person in Victoria that has not seen it.
Second last, I haven't discovered it.
Oh, it's well worth a look at. So you know, television, spending time with the family. You learn in this sort of job to sort of connect and disconnect. So, you know, people often talk about work-life balance. You can't have that in these sort of roles, but you can integrate your work and life in a way that actually you can turn one off and turn one back on, and I find that works pretty well. So, I know for me it is trying to get a bit of exercise, you know, keeping an eye on my weight's always hard, particularly during lockdown, as many of us experience. And walking and spending time with the family. Pretty simple things. I've got a couple of grandkids I haven't seen for a little while because of lockdown, so looking forward to spending some time with them in the coming months, those type of things.
Yeah, and just back on, you know, more serious things, in terms of our emergence from COVID, which I think we're going to hear about it for years to come, but in terms of Ambulance Victoria and coming out of COVID, what do you think is the biggest challenge in the workforce and getting through this?
I think the fact that demand for our services is going to continue despite the fact we're living with COVID differently. So I think we've got a lot of catch up to do for people's health over the last few years. That will challenge the system, I think, for the few years to come. But I also think it's a great opportunity. I've got to say, you know, in talking to some of my colleagues in the Department of Health and other health services, we've got a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to redesign our health system, to actually take the good things that have come out of a pandemic, and hard as that might believe now, but there are some, to say, how can we do things differently in the way we look after primary health, care for ourselves, care for our communities? What role do paramedics play in the next few years in different types of roles in primary health and supporting GPs and other health professionals? So I think it's about how do we design our services so we just don't keep doing more of the same. Our lives have been disrupted. It's been hard, but there's good that's come out of this. I look at the way we deal with homelessness in the community. I think it's been much better managed now as a result of what we've had to do through the pandemic. Well, let's make sure we don't lose that going forward. Let's make sure we take the good things forward.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And for those listeners who may have let their ambulance membership lapse, what would you say to them, Tony?
I would very much encourage you to become a member. It's very inexpensive. We're talking about $90-something a year for a family, and even less for that for someone single. It gives you guarantees. I mean, you know, we'll always attend whether people are subscribers or not, but you know, it just gives you that comfort to know that payment once a year, small amount of money, actually means you've got full access to all of our services wherever you are. Around Victoria, around the country. So I would absolutely encourage people to make sure it's up to date.
Tony Walker, CEO of Ambulance Victoria, it has been such a pleasure having you on and, you know, to learn so much from you during this time. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Laura.
And if you've been listening and you've enjoyed our chat with Tony Walker and you'd like to share it with a friend, subscribe to the Great Australian Lives podcast and join me the same time next week when we celebrate another great Australian life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.